Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you for tuning in today. Thank you for tuning in over the recent podcast, hitting some record numbers now of the number of people who want to lend us their lug holes, Leslie Ann. The future is bright on Planet Porky.
Isn't it exciting? It's thrilling that so many people are joining us and, getting in on our conversation, which I just love welcoming these people along.
We certainly do. Now, fortunately, we are a medium that people can pick up on their mobile phone or they can go onto their laptop. And there's a half dozen different ways of listening to us. But thank goodness we don't communicate with our people out there, our followers, through newspapers. Because if we did, we'd have been silenced on Saturday morning, wouldn't we?
Well, absolute nonsense, isn't it? Extinction Rebellion, they seem to be against everything and everyone, as my brother said yesterday. You know, they don't like human beings. It's almost as though they don't like themselves and they don't want anybody else to have a life either. Yeah. But did no one ever explain to them that the whole point of PR is to get the press on side so that you can advertise your causes? You don't want to alienate the newspapers.
Yeah, they're a bunch of tossers, honestly. You know, the core of them are a bunch of middle-aged liberals who've got nothing better to do, seriously. They've been infiltrated now by hard left commies, okay, and of course they want to bring down entire society. They just want chaos. They want capitalism to collapse. They want buildings to fall in. They want, you know, weeds growing in the street so we can go back to year zero, because they're just mental nutters. But then to interfere with everybody else's life, I read a terrible story this morning about an old woman, 95. She fell over on the pavement going from her home to a news agent's to find out where her paper had got to, because that's the only solace she has in the mornings, is the paper coming through the letterbox, you know what I mean? And she went waddling off down the road. She very rarely goes out, fell over and hurt herself. They're just scum and I hate them. But I'm also very critical of Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, and she says it's completely unacceptable. So why do we accept it? I've just been looking at the police response, right? I've been looking at the records there. It took the police something like 10 hours to decide it was an illegal demonstration and they would move in and try and remove these people from the bamboo frames they chained themselves to. The response from the police, Leslie Ann, should have been to get in there with batons and clear the road to let the lorries out and allow people to benefit from what is so precious to us, the freedom of the press.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you about the batons, but, no, you know, there wasn't a lot of social distancing going on there. And all of those people should have been arrested for that reason and fined £10,000 each. The thing is that they've maintained that they want to peacefully occupy centres of power and shut them down. Mm. But they're not doing anything peacefully. Mm. They're disrupting people's lives. They're disrupting civilization. And this has got to stop.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. Anyway, look, we've got a lot of stories to talk about today. One of the stories which has most harrowed me, I think, over the last few months is the fate of Kate Garraway's husband, Derek Draper. We used to call him Dolly Draper when we worked in Fleet Street. He was a political lobbyist with the Blair government, you know, and he was well known around Whitehall and around Fleet Street. It was his job to try and bend people's ears, you know what I mean, and get them his way. But we already knew how terrible it was, and Derek's still in a semi-coma and, you know, been attacked all the organs of his body and all that. But Kate did a talk yesterday, New Magazine, the magazine out of the Mail on Sunday, and revealed that he's lost 8 stone while he's been in this coma. And, you know, his condition is still critical. The poor woman must be living a daily nightmare.
Well, she must, and because to lose 8 stone for most of us, I mean, that would be most of me gone, you know. He wasn't that huge a guy, was he? No. But I mean, that means he's lost muscle mass from throughout his body, which is very worrying. But one thing, I wish it hadn't been a fashion shoot with the temple-y suits and, you know, the makeup by this one, styling by that one. It did seem to detract from the tragedy of their lives in a way for me.
Yeah, now, you see, I feel very sensitive about this because poor old Kate must be going through everything. Within that piece, she explained that if she made the decision to go back to work for her children, and I think today she's starting back at Heart Radio, she started back already on GMB with Piers Morgan. I think today she goes back to her second job at Heart Radio, mid-morning.
It's smooth, isn't it? Yeah.
Sorry, smooth. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. she said within that piece, look, if I made the decision to go back for my children to try and get life somewhere normal with my family, then I had to go back on the basis that I was the person before this tragedy. So on GMB, she's smiling all the time. She gets all the trolls who are sending a message saying, how can you smile when your husband's so critically ill? And she made the point, but there's no point in me going back unless I can be the person I was. It's the same on radio. Now, I agree with you about the fashion shoot thing. I thought, this is a bit at odds, really, with the tragic story she's telling. But I thought her face was so rigid, as though she'd pumped it full of Botox, there didn't seem to be any feeling in her face. She seemed to be very aware that maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, like she's wearing a mask of courage. You know, she's done this for her children. Yeah. She's professional. She's gone back. She's holding the fort and running the family. Yeah. I can't see that Derek can make a comeback from this, frankly.
Well, look, that's a very harsh thing to say, but very brutally honest, you know, and it's, I think it's something that none of us really want to have to face up to, that, you know, Kate Garrigue will certainly never get back the husband she had before. But will it ever happen? I'll tell you a tragic story. The Hillsborough tragedy, in which 96 people were killed, there was one lad there, right, who was in a coma for literally months. I think it might have been years, to be honest. I'm in a hospital, I think, in Sheffield. And about this muscle wastage and all that, every day, twice a day, a physiotherapist had to come and massage his legs and his arms, because if you don't, your body, it just curls up, you know what I mean, into the fetal position. And you have to, you know, you have to, I mean, it's a horrible thing to talk about, but that's the sort of daily procedure that, you know, that Derek Draper will be going through. And once again, it is simply a living nightmare, because, you know, she's waiting for a phone call at any time to say things are better, and dreading a phone call at any time, which might say things are worse. But anyway, look, let's lighten the proceedings, because we're here to give both shade and light in our proceedings. It's the
but all our best wishes to her. Oh, and, you know, she's back playing great music on the radio, and yes, hoping, I think, that some of that might flick some switches in his brain and yeah, get him powered up again. So all power to both of them.
Oh, definitely. And you know, I'm sure people are praying all the time, all around the world, that things will get right. Let's hope they will. Now, as the queen of rock chic writing extraordinaire, did you ever come across Chrissy Hynde?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She piece of work, Chrissy Hynde. Right. She never suffered fools, that one.
69 today, and doesn't look 69 to me. I've always regarded her as one of these women of great reality who just got on with life. And is that how she came over to you?
Yeah, she gave as good as she got. You know, she was one of the boys. Yeah. She made a decision very early on to be a rock star, a musician, rather than I'm a girl doing a boy's job.
Right.
It was never about that with her. She was famously married to Jim Kerr, wasn't she, from
yes,
Simple Minds?
Yes.
They had a child together, I think. She was also with Nick Kent in the very early days.
Right.
Quite an important music writer way back when.
Indeed. And, you know,
but I always loved her, actually. I liked the Pretenders music. Did you?
Yes, I did. Chain Gang.
back on the oh, chain. God, why did I say that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think she was terrific. Everything
demonstrating very well that you don't actually play guitar in real life, Michael.
No, of course not. No, I'm playing the air guitar now. But, what I was going to say was, when I read things about her, she's very pragmatic. You know, she says, oh, you know, bollocks, of course there's sexism in rock and roll. You know, how do you think we all got on in the early days and all that kind of stuff? You know what I mean? And talks about it. But you said she was married to Jim Kerr. I bet you don't know who Jim Kerr's best schoolboy friend was. It was my footballing and broadcasting mate, Alan Brazil. They were in the...
Oh, really? I was going to say it probably was you.
No, it wasn't me. No, because, of course, he's a Scot. But they went to the same high school. They sat next to each other in class in Glasgow. And Jim Kerr goes on to become, you know, world-famous lead singer of a pop group. Alan Brazil goes on to play football for Scotland. You know, that's quite an achievement, really, from one class, isn't it?
Well, they obviously spurned each other on, but I was thinking back to Chrissy Hynde's famous line, you know, about girls in the rock industry. And she said, it's not F me, it's F you, which I always thought was brilliant from a woman.
Yeah. I remember a picture of her riding around Central Park in a horse-drawn buggy with one of her husbands, but I can't remember which one it was. Do you remember that?
Oh, as if you do that. Have you ever done that? I did do it once with one of my kids, just for the tourist experience, you know. But
no, I haven't.
I feel so sorry for those horses.
Yeah, I do. They're mangy looking, some of them, right? And
yeah, terrible. They are. They all are.
They all are. There's a terrible smell around there often because of the horse manure that's on the road and all that. The carriages look grubby to me. I wouldn't want to sit on the seats, to be honest. And I think they've been banned now, haven't they? If they haven't,
I don't know. I've not obviously been in New York for a while, like everybody else. But if they're not, they should have been. People get married in those things.
They do, right? I know. I love Central Park, and a lot of it's to do, of course, with John Lennon living in the Dakota on Central Park West. Was that? Yeah.
Yes.
I love staying when I go to New York. I like to stay in the Essex House on Central Park South. Get a room high up and overlook the park. I mean, I love wandering through the park to the lake and all that. You know, I really do. I think it's great, particularly in the winter. I like it when the snow is down. And talking about Central Park, talking about John Lennon, of course, congratulations, Miss Jones, on the serialisation, the first serialisation of your what's going to be best-selling book, Who Killed John Lennon, in a Sunday newspaper spread. I thought it was fantastic.
That's very decent of you, Michael. Thank you.
Alma Cogan. A lot of people won't have known that story before you revealed it. Tell us about it.
A lot of people wouldn't have known who Alma Cogan was, but she was actually the first female pop star in this country.
Yeah.
And John used to send her up mercilessly. She was, you know, 50s, sticky out frocks, and she'd sing very sort of saccharine songs. Yeah. She was massively popular, had her own TV shows and all that. Mm-hmm. Many, many hits. You know, your parents would have loved her.
Yeah.
She was of her time, I guess, of the 1950s style. But John used to send her up and do wicked impersonations of her at college. And Cynthia, his first wife, said to me she was devastated when she discovered that John and Alma were carrying on, as she put it, in those days. Because as far as she was concerned, John thought Alma was ridiculous. But of course, he did have this thing for the older woman. I think Alma was about 8 years older than him.
Wow.
Yoko, who he married eventually, was 7 years older than him.
Right, yeah.
That is quite a gap.
Yeah,
it does sort of take you over the line
at that age.
Yeah,
if you're a teenager, you're marrying a woman who's in her sort of late 20s.
But he did look up to her, and George Harrison said he was absolutely potty about Alma. But they used to stay in London hotels and sort of have their trysts, and they'd check in as Mr. and Mrs. Winston. That was John's middle name.
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. And did she ever support the Beatles on one of their early tours or anything of Britain? Was she a
No, she didn't do that, but she did record quite a number of their songs, you know, did cover versions of them.
Yeah.
Went in later times when she was trying to revive her career and stuff, and could see where the 60s music was going, which was not in her direction.
Yes, well, there you go. And just to remind our listeners, Leslie, and I think your book is out a week today, next Tuesday, isn't it?
It's actually officially published on the 17th of September, which is a Thursday.
Right. Okay.
And the full title is Who Killed John Lennon? The Lives, Loves and Deaths of the Greatest Rock Star.
Yeah, very good. Brilliant. Well done. And done with your old mate, John Blake at Blake Publishing. Is John still run now?
Actually, no, it's not. Everybody's making this mistake. John Blake Publishing was bought by Bonnier Publishing some years ago. So John, God bless him, has nothing to do with this. But it's quite ironic that I end up on his imprint when he's not running it anymore.
Is it still not called John Blake within, like, the Bonnier empire? You know, like...
Yes, it's called John Blake Books.
Oh, that's what I mean, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the imprint still exists, but it isn't anything to do with John himself anymore.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Now, talking about pop stars and age and all that, I love the idea that today it's also the birthday of Gloria Gaynor, right? And I have to say that her song, I Will Survive, it's got to be one of the most famous songs of all time, because not only was it iconic in its day, but every time a woman now splits up with her husband or they have a bust up or a divorce coming, the woman goes out publicly. Somebody like Nancy Dell'Olio would do this sort of thing, you know what I mean? And then invites a photographer around with a video camera and tells the DJ to put I Will Survive on and starts jiving as though nothing's wrong.
It is an anthem, isn't it? I had the great, massive pleasure of seeing Gloria Gaynor live in Sitges, Spain, in 2018.
Right.
I was down there staying with Dave Hancock. Do you remember from the Evening Standard
And his Hancock partner? Photographer.
Dave Hancock, the journalist.
Oh, journalist. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And we went, we managed to get tickets to Gloria Gaynor. It was an open-air gig just outside Sitges. And when she sang I Will Survive, the stadium erupted. Everybody was on their feet. We were literally screaming the lyrics.
Yeah.
It's a punching the air. You know, this is, let's hear it for the girls. This is our all our divorce song.
Right.
And, you know, the words are so apt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was magnificent.
Yeah, she was absolutely magnificent. I totally agree. She had reportedly had a fling with Jesse Jackson. The Reverend Jesse Jackson was the first sort of serious black politician in America. He was a precursor, really, to Barack Obama, because he stood at every election, but only ever got a very small percentage of the votes from the Deep South. You know what I mean? Nobody took him seriously, but he was Jesse Jackson. And although he was a reverend, it was reported that, you know, he was getting to know his flock rather well, particularly in terms of Ms. Gloria Gaynor. But the reason why I remember it so fondly is that I got my first home of my own, first little home, when I went to work for the Birmingham Evening Mail. And I worked in a town called Redditch, which is on the Worcestershire-Warwickshire border. And it was a new town. It was Redditch New Town. And so they built like thousands of homes to try and get people, suck people in to make Redditch a developed town. You see what I mean? And you could hire a lovely little one-bedroom flat for £10 a week, right? And of course,
£10 a week?
A week, £10 a week.
Good God.
Yeah. Now, I'd only previously ever lived in places with other people. You know what I mean? I'd shared a house in Newcastle. I'd shared a house when I was away at the University of Trent in Nottingham. And all I ever wanted was my place of my own. You know what I mean? So because we were on the newspaper, we knew the local housing officer, a guy called Ernie Bond, who was a complete drunk. We used to meet him in the pub every night after work. He was an absolute stand-up, fall-down drunk. You know what I mean? And you bought him a few drinks. Hi, Ernie, how are you doing? And next day I was allocated a flat, you know, even though there's a 2,000 person waiting list. And I remember, you know, in the space of weeks.
You jumped the waiting list. How shameful.
I did, yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, I didn't care for the, you know, the single mothers, you know, who were living in bed and breakfast and all that. I was heartless.
Michael, that's an awful admission.
I know. It's a terrible admission and all that. But neither did Bernie, Ernie, as long as I kept buying him booze. You know what I mean? It wasn't
Well, you're turning the audience off in droves here for your shameful admission.
Well, it is a bit shameful, I suppose. But, you know, my view is I was a key worker. I was providing information
Of course you were a key worker, yeah.
In the pages of the Birmingham Evening Mail, which, by the way, sold 330,000 copies a night in those days, more than twice what The Guardian sells a day now.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. But anyway, point of my story is, so, you know, within a couple of weeks, I'd furnished, I'd gone and bought secondhand carpets, secondhand furniture everywhere, gone to the Salvation Army sales room, got the stuff there, you know what I mean? Because you do, you just, and then the television arrived, okay? And in those days, we all hired televisions. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know why.
We rented them from Rediffusion on the high street.
Exactly.
Yeah. Imagine renting a television today.
I know. It's unbelievable.
It cost about 50p a week or something to hire a telly, didn't it?
Yes, it did. You're absolutely right, honestly. And so the last thing I needed was the last thing I got round to getting was the telly, because I hadn't got a television point. Well, I did, but it was on a cable. It was all very complicated. You had to get your cable wired up, and that took 2 weeks or something like that. You know what I mean? Anyway, finally it's all coming around, and a guy rang me in the office, the Evening Mail office, and said, we've got your telly. We can bring it. Be there at 6 o'clock tonight. So he came round, and they had to mess around with the cable and all that. But eventually it was there, and I said, thank you very much indeed. And by that time, it was 7:30, and I switched on, and the very first thing that came on top of the pops was Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. So it was almost like, you know, a sort of, you know, welcome to your new home type song for me. It was brilliant.
Well, I think that's the point of a song like this, that everybody has some sort of connotation.
Yes.
It, you know, it has some link to something significant that's happened in your life.
Yes.
For most of us women who love to sing that song when we do karaoke,
yes,
which I try not to do very often
because
I can't really sing. Yes. You know, it is a divorce anthem and it's all power to the girls. Get on with it. You know, you got rid of that one. He was a loser.
Yeah.
Onwards and upwards, ladies. It's that kind of song, isn't it?
There's a woman called Della somebody, and she's married to the bloke who was married to... Do you remember the scandal about the white bars when they got married? You know, the snowflake bars.
Oh, I know who you mean. Yeah. Anthea Turner, yeah. She's now engaged to an old friend of mine.
Oh, is she? Oh, how nice.
A guy called Mark, who's a sort of king of clubs around town.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, she married a right louse who was previously married to a woman called Della. And this lady, Della, you know, was losing her husband to Anthea Turner, big scandal and all that. And they tracked her down to a skiing holiday in the Alps somewhere. And she did exactly that when she realised the press had found her. She, you know, paid the DJ to play I Will Survive, then got on the dance floor smiling and all that for the cameras and all that, I remember. Said louse, and I can't remember his name. Was it?
No, I'm glad we can't remember his name, because he was a creep, wasn't he?
Bovey, was that his name? His name was Bovey.
Oh, yeah, I think it was Grant Bovey.
Grant Bovey, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
He eventually went bust to the tune of about 50 million quid when he was trying to develop property and all that kind of stuff. But anyway.
But not only that, he married Anthea and then he cheated on her with someone much younger, which proves my theory, as we've talked about in previous podcasts.
Yeah.
You know, never get with somebody who would leave their wife and children for you, because guess what? They're going to leave you for somebody else.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And do you know what the most telling thing about how nice a person Anthea Turner must be is that she's still got, I read this recently, a very strong relationship with Grant Bovey's daughters, to whom, of course, she became stepmother when she was married to Grant Bovey, but now they're divorced. But she sees those girls all the time. They come and stay with her, and that sounds like really nice, doesn't it?
Well, that's quite right. You know, I was disappointed in Nigella, for whom I have a lot of time,
yeah,
because when she and Charles Saatchi separated, yeah, and then divorced,
yeah,
she no longer had anything to do with his daughter,
right.
Phoebe, I think her name is.
Ah.
And of course, children come to depend on their step-parents. And I'm glad Anthea has maintained those relationships, because, you know, they deserve each other. They were together all those years. Why would you sever those relationships?
Yeah. No, I perfectly understand. I tell you what I was going to mention to you. Piers, of course, is back. He'd been away on a holiday, obviously. I think he started back last week. And I was delighted to read recently that now Simon Cowell can't be head judge in Britain's Got Talent because he fell off his bike, didn't he, and busted his back up. You know what I mean?
So, it was an electric bike, wasn't it?
Electric bike, that's right. So Piers very cheekily, because he knows Cal very well, and of course he was on the American version, I think, of America's Got Talent or something, wasn't he? Or was he on the English version?
Well, Cowell gave him the first job on the English version, and that's really what made Piers's name, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, Piers's editor in the Mirror had been promoting Cowell's artist for years and years and years, so it was a bit of payback, really, wasn't it? Although I'm not suggesting...
And he was very good at it. I thought he was a fantastic judge.
I was about to say, I'm not suggesting that Piers didn't deserve it. He was very good indeed. But anyway... So Simon goes off and then it's announced that he won't be able to be chair. So Piers sends a message off to the production company saying, yeah, Simon can't do it. I'll be chief judge. And at which point David Walliams finds out about this. He's another member of the judging panel, obviously, David Walliams of Little Britain fame, and threatens to walk out altogether because he so hates Piers Morgan.
Well, there's a bit of history here, because I think a while back, Piers had noticed that David Walliams was liking critical tweets about him.
Yes.
And, you know, probably a bit of rivalry there, bit of jealousy. I couldn't really see those two on the same panel.
Mm.
In some ways, they're too similar.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think Walliams is very full of himself. I mean, don't get me wrong, he's a very successful man. I thought he was very funny. Was it called Little Britain or Great Britain?
Yeah, it was Little Britain.
I thought he was excellent in that. But I haven't really seen him star in anything much since then. Although I think he's also a best-selling author of children's books as well.
Well, he is, you know, but for my money, he's stolen Roald Dahl's career, because his kids' books are in a very similar vein to Roald Dahl's, and they're not a patch on the originals, but they sell millions and millions of copies.
Yeah,
what I'm thinking about Piers and David, though, could this be one of those sort of fake rows for the sake of publicity, do you think?
I don't think so, because I read, you know, like you did, about the history of all this, and some of the stuff Piers has said about Walliams is very nasty. Although, funny enough, he had the same sort of relationship with Jeremy Clarkson for years, even to the point where Clarkson thumped him, I think, at some awards dinner, didn't he? Knocked him off the stage. I mean, literally...
Wouldn't Yeah, I think I remember that. But they have to have their rivals, don't they? It's kind of a boy thing, I think. Maybe women do it as well. But then they can have the big sort of making up session and the photo shoot and the whole stuff. I'm sure that they will make up.
Well, you know, we'll have to see it. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much for joining us. Leslie-Anne, of course, full of all the showbiz stories, which you would expect from a rock chic writer extraordinaire. Talking about those showbiz stories, Leslie, and what about this? Lifeline for pubs that gave stars their first gig. Somebody's trying to start a sort of organisation which goes around saving pubs where people made their first appearances. Charity Plunkett Foundation gets pleas for grants from community groups wanting to take over pubs under threat, particularly in the pandemic, where famous people have played. One, this will be of particular interest to you, Leslie-Anne, is Hull's The Polar Bear, where a young David Bowie appeared in the 1960s in his first public appearance, but not as a musician, as a mime artist.
Yeah, well, David was a mime artist when he couldn't give it away as a well, he tried everything, pop, rock, folk. You know, he was supporting Mark Bolan on tour at one point as a mime artist.
Yeah.
But the very first
What do you mean as a mime artist? I mean, a mime artist to me is that French guy who uses his hands to pretend he's climbing up windows. Is that the same sort of...
Marcel Marceau. Yeah, that's exactly the stuff Bowie was doing.
Right.
Because he just couldn't give it away for the longest time. And, you know, we know he had a breakthrough eventually with Space Oddity. But the very first pop that he performed in as a musician is actually the Three Tons on Beckenham High Street, where he was running an arts lab. And I actually, bizarrely, went to see him there when I was a little kid.
Really?
Because my friend Lisa at school, her mum was a photographer on a local paper, the Beckenham Record. Mm. And my mum and dad had gone off to some football do on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah. And Lisa's mum was looking after me, two little tiny kids, and she took us along. And so I was exposed to David Bowie and Mark Bolan on the same afternoon in the back room of that pub. Yeah. Mm. But I think they might be a bit late with this one because many of those pubs have been knocked down already.
Some of them have, but this one apparently hasn't. So, you know, it's a plea to keep it going. I live in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, and there's loads of pubs around there. There's about half a dozen at least that claim the Stones played their first gig, you know what I mean? But somewhere down into Redhill or somewhere like that, you know what I mean? And you see the plaques on the wall all over the place. But I suppose in those days, of course, those groups which became the world supergroups did start in pubs, didn't they?
Well, they did. And of course, nobody knew who they were going to be. Yeah. You know, there was no indication that they were going to be sort of world beating supergroups or anything like that.
Yeah.
It always makes me laugh when several pubs or venues claim to have been the first one where the Stones played. It's like when you go to Zanzibar, you know, and you want to find out where Freddie Mercury lived when he was a baby. Yeah. There's about 17 flats and houses there that are all claimed to have been his first childhood home.
Good God. Yeah, couldn't make it up. Now then, Leslie-Anne, of course, you are a very good-looking woman. You always have been.
Oh, Michael.
Well, you know, I'd say that it's a matter of fact. Have you ever thought of employing a professional face reader who should be able to tell you, just from looking at your face and the lines on your face and the shape of your eyebrows and all that, A, what you've done in your life, B, what you should be doing in your life, and C, what is yet to come in your life?
Well, what a load of nonsense, don't you think? I mean, this is a bit like people who say they read dreams and auras and stuff. I mean, who knows? Did God have a word with these people and tell them the answers? I don't think so. It's like going to a psychic. Have you ever been to a psychic, by the way?
The only time that happened, we were in Scotland and we were staying at the Carlton St. George in Hamilton Square, okay? Or it might have been George Square, I'm not sure. It was a square. And it was a lovely hotel in the corner of the square. And that night, there was a carnival going on in the middle of the square, you know, fairground rides and all that kind of stuff. But there was also a Gypsy Rose Lee fortune-telling place, okay? And we were doing a show the following morning, a breakfast show. We were starting at 6 or something like that. We'd out and had a few beers. And I thought, I'll go in here and get this done, something to talk about on the show tomorrow. And it was as pathetic as I thought it was, you know what I mean? Let me read your palm.
Yeah, reading faces is like reading a palm, is, or tarot cards or whatever else. I mean, look, nobody can predict the future. Nobody at all. Well, so anyone telling you they can read the lines on your face is having you on. They saw you coming.
Well, here, let me read this to you. It's one report of somebody who had it done. The eyes may be the window to the soul, but what do other features reveal about your personality and even your prospects? One report here says, I was told I have a meaty nose. Meaty? What's that?
Yeah. A meaty nose. Come here and let me have a bite.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently it's a good thing, says this woman who had her face red. It means wealth and good marriage prospects. And to prove it, I'm told a story about a woman who had a plastic surgery to reduce the size of her nose, then found herself divorced and penniless because she downgraded her meaty nose. It sounds like a load of nonsense to me.
Doesn't it, Justin?
My face, Leslie Ann, has always been described as, certainly in the last 20 years, as lived in. Okay, would you agree with that that expression?
Yeah, it is lived in, but it suits you, and it's a very open, kind of welcoming face. I like talking to your face.
You like talking to my face, and so you think I'm lived in. Lived in actually means ugly, doesn't it? Craggy.
No, it does. No, no, no. Ugly is a face only a mother could love.
Oh, is it? Yeah, well, I've got one of those, I don't think. My mother always loved me anyway. God rest her soul.
Of course she did, but no, you've got a nice face, Mike. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, okay. We often talk about people's birthdays, right? You won't believe it, but since you and I last conversed, the birthday happened of an outstanding person in British society, somebody we should all look up to and admire, and it's Pippa Middleton,
he's having us on, folks.
I am having you on, who has turned 37. And honestly, Pippa Middleton is one of those people, a bit like, for instance, Prince Edward, who often, when somebody mentions them in company, I say, what is the point of Pippa Middleton? Can you tell me, Leslie Ann?
Well, I mean, what does she do? She has tennis lessons. She goes out for lunch. She takes fitness classes. She bosses her cleaners, housekeepers, nannies and gardeners around. I know a little bit about that because I had all that when I was, you know, wealthily married, yeah. Let's say. Yeah. I was a spoilt rich wife for about 11 years.
Yeah.
And I actually, today, I hate people coming into my house to do jobs for me. The only one of those aforementioned that I have anymore is a gardener because I have a huge garden and I can't do it myself. Yeah. I'm not inclined to, but the rest of it I do myself. Mm. But this is what these women do, and they come to rely on vast teams of people who run their lives.
Right.
To the point that they're sitting there wondering what they're for. So it's not just us wondering what is Pippa Middleton for. She's wondering herself.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure she is. Pointless life. And, you know, even now, you know, I dread the thought that one of these days I'll be retired because I simply couldn't get up in the morning without having some focus in my day. You're exactly the same. You've got a very
busy
day today. You're going to be filming after we've done this podcast. You've got things to do this evening. You and I have exchanged our diaries for the next week or two. We're busy every day. What would you do if you woke up one morning and there was nothing to get up for?
See, I didn't remember this because although I had three children, I wasn't working. I'd left the News of the World to marry my husband, who said very loftily, no wife of mine works for the News of the World. You know, that was my best job ever in my life.
Yeah, well,
and Piers Morgan hired me. And yeah, to go from that to being a housewife and mother, nothing wrong with bringing up your children.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there is. But I needed something else as well. Mm. And those wilderness years for me, looking back on them, were not productive years. I think I would have been a better mother had I been working at the same time.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And what a sacrifice to, I mean, you know, they don't hand out jobs as columnists and feature writers on the biggest selling Sunday newspaper in the world, willy-nilly. You've got to work for decades to earn the privilege to get that job. And for you to have given that up was an immense sacrifice. Did you never think twice about it?
Well, I was blindly in love with this kind of Superman, wasn't I, at the time? And, you know, whatever he said went. I can't quite believe that version of myself now, but that's who I was at the time.
Yeah, and Piers was your editor then, was he?
Yeah, he hired me.
Yeah, well, I think Piers only stayed a year, didn't he, and then moved to the Mirror.
It wasn't that long, was it? I mean, you know what it's like. The holy grail for a newspaper editor is to edit a daily newspaper.
Yeah.
And those kind of jobs don't come up very often.
No,
so, of course, he was going to jump at it. And then Phil Hall took over as editor of the News of the World.
Yeah.
And it was about that time that I was getting married and so on. It just made sense to leave, to move on.
Because one of the bugbears of my life, and I've got a lot more sympathy for the situation these days than I had then, was appointing women executives, right, for two reasons. And I know this sounds terribly, terribly,
sexist.
Yeah, sexist and, what they call a male chauvinist paganism and all that. But appointing women executives, the issue was, were they going to become pregnant? And if so, how much time did they want off? Perfectly, acceptable to ask them that question, that kind of stuff. But the second one was those who didn't do what you did and decided to become working mothers, in a newspaper environment, their lives were utter misery. I've often had to allow a woman to go home because the nanny's taken ill and the nanny's had to go home, leaving the children at home with nobody and their mothers had to go home. Or I've sent a woman away on an overseas job and lo and behold, she begged me to come home because one of her children's fallen ill or something like that. It is a terrible pressure. And working mothers who do a job in journalism do have a sense of guilt all the time.
Well, yeah, but that's a sexist situation in itself because most children have two parents, or they should have.
Yes.
It takes a man and a woman, guess what, to make a baby. So the male should have as much responsibility for those children as the woman should have. Mm-hmm. So if the woman is away on a job, why isn't the dad stepping up, There was a situation with Gabby Logan, wasn't there, during the last Olympics, I think,
right,
when she was away doing some coverage, presenting and so on. And she was asked in interviews, how could she go away and leave her children for that length of time?
Yeah.
And she retorted, nobody's asking my husband that question.
Yes, no, absolutely. Talking about women and babies and fathers and all that, what do you think of this guy, Julian Assange? As we're talking now, I think his hearing against extradition, because there's an application from the United States for him to go back there. That starts today. He's fighting it because he knows he'll probably get jailed for the rest of his life in a very unpleasant underground prison in the United States. But this guy lived in that, was it the Bolivian?
It was the Ecuadorian embassy.
For about, was it 7 years or something?
Yeah, but, and fathered two children while he was inside.
I was about to say, we only found out recently, while he was in there, he was shagging some woman who'd, sort of gone into, it's probably a bit unfair because she's the mother of his children, but
I think they were in a relationship rather than it was just a shag,
Yeah, but I mean, she went in there originally to, to assist him in his battle, for, freedom and all this kind of stuff. Because at the time, he was in the Ecuador embassy because he was trying to stop being extradited to Sweden, where he was wanted on alleged rape charges.
And he outstayed his welcome, of course, staying at the embassy, didn't he?
Yeah.
But it's a very complicated story. There are obviously many sides to it. Mm. You're right. If he goes to the States and he's tried, we probably never see or hear of him again.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for the kids.
Yeah.
And she's making the point that his children will never know him because they're only little. Mm. They won't ever know their father. He won't be able to bring them up. So, I think, bottom line, it's about the kids, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But he just strikes me as being a particularly unpleasant person. And once again, and this never fails to amaze me, once again, all sorts of women are queuing up to, I don't know, just praise him, laud him, including old Baywatch Pamela, who's...
Oh, Pamela Anderson, yeah, she used to visit him regularly, didn't she?
But why? I mean, he's, if he's not a nasty bit of stuff, he's certainly a very peculiar bloke. Anybody who can live in a tiny, literally a tiny little room in a foreign embassy for 7 years and dash around up and down the hall, which is only 12 yards long on a skateboard, got to be mad. Why would you want to be associated with him? And that brings me on to another thing, which is one of the weirdest things in society. The Yorkshire Ripper talking recently in a piece I read about him having to make his mind up about who his next girlfriend's going to be because he gets 100 letters a month from women who want to meet him. I mean,
you hear of this all the time, don't you? There's some dreadful sort of hold that these monsters have on certain types of weak people.
Yeah.
And they start corresponding. You've heard a lot of stories about women who marry serial killers and so on.
Yeah.
They have some sort of charisma that they manage to exude some sort of power over weaker people and make them think that there's something more to them. It's almost like a magic spell that goes on, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about relationships like that, I was leafing through the papers the other day, came across one of these agony aunt columns and all that, but quite, you know, quite a sophisticated one, not Dear Deirdre. And this, I remember the strap across the top, "I want to stop visiting my nasty mother because this woman..."
Oh, I read it. Yeah, yeah.
And this poor woman, and it's another familial dispute. And I tell you what, Leslie Ann, every family's got them. Because at the end of the day, you fall out, and I have a situation in my family, right, where for years I had a problem with another member of the family, but my mum was alive, and my mum always came on the phone. "So you've got to make it up. I'm not having you fall out with other members of the family. You know, I can't bear it. You know, what's it going to be like at Christmas and all that?" And so for years, probably 30 years, I did, honestly. I always gave in the end and rang up, made peace, and life resumed as normal. But since mum died, all the bitterness has built up, and I'm not in a forgiving mood anymore, going back 30 years. So I've been separated from contact with a member of my family for nearly 12 months now. But there's nothing I can do about it because I so dislike the situation behind it. I don't want to give in, and I don't want anything to do with them. And it's very sad because other members of the family, of course, feel uneasy, and we now have two separate camps at Christmas.
Yeah, it is really sad. My mother and I were talking about this yesterday because two of my cousins, who are twins, one of the cousins was married to a guy who hanged himself when he found out she was having an affair with someone else. And the twins have broken up because of it, because the other twin's husband was very close friends as well as related to the guy who hanged himself.
Yeah.
And they can't forgive her for the fact that he took his own life because she was cheating on him.
Yeah.
Now, my view there is that nobody has an affair if everything is all right at home.
Right.
So, you know, nobody really knows what went on. But this is awful because these twins, you know, you're not just siblings and close and sisters. You've been brought up. You've been joined at the hip literally since before you were born.
Yeah.
So that is a particularly sad situation.
Certainly,
but it's so true that every family has these things. I tend to think life's too short. The older I get, you know, make peace, especially if your parents are still alive.
Yeah.
Make it nicer for them. Make it easier on them. Mm. And everybody just make up.
Yeah.
I know sometimes things are very hard to get over, but Mike, you know, you haven't got endless life to live. Would it really not make your life easier to get on with these people?
The trouble in families is that you can get on all right with one sibling or one member of your family, but then it's the people they marry that come into the family, which I often think are the problem, and the problem that brings with them. Like, for instance, one of the bugbears is always stepchildren, isn't it? You know, if two people meet and one of them's already got an 8-year-old child from a first marriage, everything's going fine until issues start arising over the stepchild. Like, for instance, the Boris Becker situation and his current girlfriend and the mother of his child and her going mad, you know, about the current girlfriend putting sun cream on the back of her child. That's the big problem, isn't it?
It is galling when, you know, some other woman steps in and starts to assume responsibility for your little children.
Yeah.
You just have to swallow it because the other parent has a right to spend as much time with the child as you do.
Yeah.
And if that person has a new partner, you've just got to suck it up, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I've talked myself into, I have to have decent relationships with all the partners of my children going forward.
Yeah.
Otherwise, because they're very strong individuals, I will not see my children.
Sure.
So it's in my best interests to have good, strong, solid, positive relationships with all their partners.
Yeah.
And I will strive very hard to make that happen.
Yeah, great. Anyway, let's finish on something a bit lighter than familial problems. Were you ever a big fan of The Only Way Is Essex, or did you ever get to write about it? Or
no,
no.
That's my idea of hell, is to watch TOWIE, I'm afraid.
No, I totally agree. And I never watch it. I could never, when I did watch it like for 5 minutes, I could never work out whether it was a blinking comedy, whether it was a drama, whether it was like Hollyoaks, or whether it was like EastEnders, or whether these people were actually so dim and you know, unaware of themselves that it was reality. But apparently,
I think all of the above, actually, yeah.
Yeah. But apparently it was reality. Anyway, the only reason I mention it is that apparently they're having a reunion. So God knows what that'll be like. But a guy called Mark Wright, who I have heard of because he married that actress who's done very well since she left Coronation Street. You know the girl I mean?
The one who's so well known that we can't think of the name, yeah.
She's in some TV series called Our Girl or something. She's supposed to be like a special SAS type woman soldier, but she's so beautiful and so glamorous when she goes into battle. You know, you'd think she'd be more worried about her sort of stilettos than the bayonet on the end of a rifle type thing. And I'm being sexist and horrible there, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, you really are, yeah.
Yeah, but no, apparently there's a big row because Mark Wright, who apparently has done very well. You know, he's made a multi-million pound fortune and now does well in America, won't join the reunion because he's become too big for it. I mean, that happens a lot, doesn't it, in showbiz? People won't go back, i.e. Posh Spice, i.e. Robbie from, Take That. They become too big and they don't want to know.
I think we must never forget where we came from. Yeah, I always admired Alistair Campbell because, yeah. You know, he rose to great heights, didn't he?
Oh,
and
yeah.
All power to him. But whenever we had our little reunions in the Cheshire Cheese for Garth Gibbs's anniversary or whoever, he would always turn up and be one of the journalists again, which yeah. I thought was terrific.
Yeah, it was.
Never get above yourself. Never forget where you started.
No, I agree with that. And if there's ever anything I could do to help, like, for instance, you know, I get invited back to my school to give lectures to the pupils on work in the media and all that. Half of them never believe my stories. You know what I mean?
Are we surprised? Yeah.
Most of them never believe half of my stories, I meant to say. But it's always great to do that. And yes, I think you're absolutely right. You shouldn't forget where you came from. Alistair, by the way, you say he rose to great heights. I think he literally was the most powerful man in this country for quite a while.
Well, he was the Prime Minister, wasn't he, really? Tony Blair didn't move without Alistair kind of plotted his route.
Yeah, I've been in a situation where I've seen them together and I've seen Alistair snap at Tony Blair and admonish him as though he was the junior member of the team. You know what I mean? You know, they've been talking about something and then Tony Blair said something. Alistair snapped at him and said, you know, that's not the right approach. Don't say that. And Tony Blair's looked like a sort of a wounded child. You know what I mean? And Ali had a terrific influence. Funny enough, only the other day I read something about Alistair and his partner in life, Fiona Miller, right? She was also very powerful. She looked after Sherry and was a big influence at Downing Street as well. And I employed Fiona Miller. I gave her a first job in Fleet Street on the Daily Express. And from day one, she made it absolutely clear her ambition was to work in the House of Commons as a political reporter. She and Alistair grew up together, I think, on the mirror training scheme down in the West Country and both had political ambition. So good luck to them. Right. OK, Leslie Ann, that's it for another episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed. I understand now that you've got a day of filming ahead of you. What are you filming today?
I'm filming a documentary on Axl Rose,
wow.
You know, one of the all-time great hard rockers.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Great. All right, my dear, well, have a good day, have a good week, and we will be, to all our audience, we will be back with you again towards the end of the week. Keep listening, folks, and remember, in the pandemic, stay safe. Now, I'd only previously ever lived in places with other people, you know what I mean? I'd shared a house in Newcastle, I'd shared a house when I was away at the University of Trent in Nottingham, and all I ever wanted was my place of my own, you know what I mean? So, because we were on the newspaper, we knew the local housing officer, a guy called Ernie Bond, who was a complete drunk. We used to meet him in the pub every night after work. He was an absolute stand-up, fall-down drunk, you know what I mean? And you bought him a few drinks. Hi, Ernie, how are you doing? And next day, I was allocated a flat, you know, even though there's a 2,000-person waiting list. And I remember, you know, in the space of weeks...
You jumped the waiting list. How shameful.
I did, yeah. Yeah, oh yeah, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, I didn't care for the, you know, the single mothers, you know, who were living in bed and breakfast and all that. I was heartless.
Michael, that's an awful admission.
I know, it's a terrible admission and all that. But neither did Bernie, Ernie, as long as I kept buying him booze, you know what I mean? you like talking to my face. And so you think I'm lived in. Lived in actually means ugly, doesn't it? Craggy.
No, it does. No, no, no. Ugly is a face only a mother could love.
Oh, is it? Yeah, well, I haven't got one of those, I don't think. My mother always loved me anyway. God rest her soul.
Of course she did. But no, you've got a nice face, Mike. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, okay. Said louse, and I can't remember his name. Is it?
No, I'm glad we can't remember his name because he was a creep,
Bovey.
Wasn't he?
Bovey, was that his name? His name was Bovey.
Oh, yeah, I think it was Grant Bovey.
Grant Bovey, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.